our lives. Is this fact something the Chinese people can be proud of? Sparrow looked up, trying to find the source of the broadcast, but the endlessness of the sky made it difficult to see what was near. I have grown old, he thought. I no longer understand the ways of this world. The following morning, as they stood beneath Fan's flowery umbrella outside the factory gates, Fan gave Sparrow a pamphlet that listed the demands of the hunger strikers. There were just two: immediate dialogue on an equal footing, and an acknowledgement of the legitimacy of the student movement. Fan told him that the workers of Beijing Wire Factory No. 3 would be marching in support of the students on May 16th. She had heard that almost all of Beijing's factories, as well as scientific and educational institutes, were planning the same. Fan was unusually subdued, and when Sparrow asked if she was well, she told him that her sister in Gansu province had suffered a work accident, but Fan didn't know the severity. "And I've been going to the square every night after work," she said, "to help out where I can, because these skinny kids haven't eaten in 3 days, and the government has yet to lift a finger. How did we come to this?" Fan's troubled face turned away from him. "And I don't want to make radios anymore." She looked back and laughed, a lost, unhappy laugh. "Does anyone want to make radios?" she said. "Ugh, damn your second uncle." This was a special Beijing curse, and it made Sparrow smile. Fan raised her eyebrows, which made her ears wiggle slightly. She leaned mischievously towards him, so close their noses nearly touched. "What would you like to do, Comrade Sparrow, if you were free to choose a vocation?" He didn't hesitate. "I'd like to play the piano." Fan let out a honking laugh. Someone coming up the stairs dropped their lunch tin in surprise and let out a sad, soft, "Ha!" "It's never too late to learn," Fan shouted. Sparrow smiled. "I suppose." "But the piano kind of thing, comrade," she said, turning serious, "is a hobby and can be done in addition to a steady job. And what I meant with my question is the kind of vocation that requires a lifetime's commitment. I wanted to be a doctor. I think I told you once. I wanted to open a clinic in my sister's town. But you know how it was back then. It wasn't up to me." Rain battered dully on the umbrella. "I want to see my daughter grow up," Sparrow thought. The premonition scared him so much, he reached out his hand, intending to grasp the wall, and caught only air. Fan didn't notice. Her fingers were idly tapping the handle of the umbrella, playing an imaginary instrument. "Speaking of pianos," she said, "remember that musician in 1968? The composer from Shanghai, the tall one with the long face, what was his name? They locked us in a room and made us watch his struggle session. Old guy was being kicked around on live television and we still had to call him names."
"He Luting."
"That's it! Right on television! They were going to make a big example out of him. I haven't thought of him in years. Do you remember it?"
"I remember."
"Oh, boy. Everyone had to watch. It didn't matter whether you worked upstairs or in the basement. So we all heard it when he shouted, 'How dare you? How dare you? Shame on you for lying!' That's what he said. He kept yelling out, 'Shame! Shame!' Those red guards couldn't believe it. I can still see their faces, big eyes and dum-dum mouths. Nobody could believe it. The nerve of this guy. I wonder if he's still alive."
"I think so," Sparrow said.
"Shame on you. I'll never forget." she disappeared for a moment into her own searching. We all knew that once the cameras were switched off, pow, that would be the end of him. They wouldn't let him get away with it.
But afterwards, were you yourself different?
Fan looked at him, startled.
Comrade Sparrow, what kind of question is that? How could anyone be different?
She gave an irritated sigh.
Sure, this polluting proved that it was possible to fight back, to stand up. But I still didn't know how it was done. The Red Guards back then, the youth, you know how vicious they were.
She reached into her pocket and took out a handful of candies.
You like these, don't you, White Rabbits? Have a few of these, and don't ask me any more questions. All right, I'm a coward, but damn your questions. They make me feel like I belong in a factory and will never deserve better.
Don't be upset, Sparrow said, accepting the candy. I'm the same as you. I had the desire, but never the will.
And now?
Fan asked.
He shook his head. But it occurred to him that now, finally, when he had the will, desire itself might have disappeared. For 20 years, Sparrow had convinced himself that he had safeguarded the most crucial part of his inner life from the party, the self that composed and understood the world through music. But how could it be? Time remade a person. Time had rewritten him. How could a person counter time itself?
That night, when Aiming came home in tears, Sparrow helplessly gave her the candy. He knew that Aiming stayed in the square each day and passed herself off as a student. His daughter said that hundreds of students had lost consciousness. They were on IV drips. She had spent the day trying to keep a path clear for the stream of ambulances. How could he yell at her? More than 3,000 had joined the hunger strike, and some were threatening to set themselves on fire. But he saw, when he passed the neighborhood television, that this confrontation with the government could not go on indefinitely. He watched clips of Gorbachev's arrival in Beijing, all the members of the Politburo standing stiffly on the tarmac, their faces as gray as their colorless coats. General Secretary Zhao Ziyang had met with Gorbachev. They had sat on chairs too large for their bodies. Comrade Zhao said that some young people had doubts about socialism, that their concerns were sincere, and for this reason reform was crucial. The anchor read without looking up. The grand celebration that had been planned for Tiananmen Square, intended to celebrate the first visit by a Soviet head of state since 1959, had been cancelled. The following morning, Wednesday, Sparrow met his workmates at the Musiti Bridge. Everyone was neatly turned out in their dark blue uniforms, while around them Chang'an Avenue swelled in a kind of euphoria and sadness. People from factories across the city arrived continuously in trucks and repurposed buses. Fan was busy giving orders. She had a voice sharp enough to crack glass. Old B was there, too, with Thaurin, who carried one side of a banner that read, "We can no longer stay silent." Even the floor supervisors, managers, and superiors were walking with them. He had heard that some, including baby Corn, had children who had joined the hunger strike. And it was true. Baby Corn did not look well. An enlivening breeze made all the banners crease and ripple, and an expression of Big Mother's caught in his mind. Those who sow the wind will reap the whirlwind. At last, they set out. Behind the banner of Beijing Wire Factory No. 3, the sky was like a yellow curtain they could never quite pass through.
The air was tumultuous as Tiananmen Square came into sight. He saw banners announcing the Beijing Bus Company, Xidan Department Store, and, shockingly, the Beijing Police Academy. Ling was here too, walking alongside her co-workers at Radio Beijing. Men from Capital Iron and Steel waved orange flags that caught the sun. They were sturdy and mountainous, and had taken it upon themselves to direct traffic. Life was in flux, orchestral and completely unrecognizable. Through the loudspeakers, a student was saying, "Mother China, witness now the actions of your sons and daughters." While foreign journalists, having come to report on the Sino-Soviet summit, were so numerous they seemed to be replicating themselves from moment to moment. Journalists and editors from the People's Daily walked under a red and gold banner, the colors of sunset. Everywhere students, almost drunk with exhaustion, collected donations, and their plastic buckets and biscuit tins overflowed. The workers around Sparrow started buying up all the water, nourishing biscuits, popsicles and sticks of frozen fruit, and carting them to the hunger strikers. Sparrow felt as if all his past lives, all his selves, were walking beside him.
"Comrade Sparrow,"
Fan said, taking hold of his arm.
"Are you okay? We should find some ice for your back injury."
"I'm fine," he said. His voice was hoarse. "I never imagined so many people." Fan's smile was so wide, he was surprised to realize she was weeping. On the loudspeakers, a scholar was addressing the crowds. "There are things that I can't accept from the government, and there are extreme elements within the student movement. But history is this kind of process. It's all mixed up." In 2 weeks, he would fly to Hong Kong to see Kai. Yet he had neglected to tell Ling or his daughter this important detail. And the fact that he was hiding so many crucial things could no longer be brushed away. Chanting reverberated off all the bodies and all the buildings. Can lies go on forever? When he reached the square, he thought, so this is what Tiananmen Square looks like when it's truly full. Even Chairman Mao never lived to see it like this. Mao's portrait on the gate, so familiar it might as well be the moon in the sky, appeared smug and overdressed for the spring humidity. Despite the million demonstrators, the only visible police were the ones marching in support of the students. The student loudspeakers were exhorting the hunger strikers to be orderly, to sleep neatly, and to refrain from playing cards, because such behavior would compromise the purity of their goals. The fasting students had no mats or tarps to lie on, only sheets of grubby newspaper. A sign read, "The party maintains its power by accusing the people of fabricated political crimes." Sparrow could not imagine what this scene would look like through Julie's eyes at the age she would be now. How many deceits had the Red Guards accused her of? How many crimes had the government fabricated? How could a lie continue so long and work its way into everything they touched? But maybe Ai Ming would be allowed to come of age in a different world. A new China. Perhaps it was naive to think so. But he found it difficult not to give in, not to hope, and not to desire. Every day there were more demonstrations. 1 million people on Wednesday, and 1 million on Thursday, despite rainstorms. By now, the hunger strike was in its 6th day, and even the official People's Daily was reporting that more than 700 strikers had collapsed. When Sparrow went out, no matter the hour, he could hear ambulances racing to and from the square. His factory,
Perhaps every factory in the city had all but closed. His new composition was almost done. Reading it over, he heard a counterpoint to Gabriel Fauré's Opus 24, a similar descending sweep, and the three twisting voices of Bach's organ prelude, Ich ruf zu dir, which he had always loved. But perhaps, rather than a counterpoint, the other works were sounds overheard, lives within lives. He no longer knew. The structure of his sonata felt unbalanced, even monstrous, and even though he knew it was nearly finished, he had no idea how it would end. He called it, tentatively, The Sun Shines on the People's Square, a title that echoed Ding Ling's novel of revolutionary China, The Sun Shines Over Sangguam River. But the square in Sparrow's mind was not the Tiananmen Square of 1989. Instead, it was multiple places from throughout his life. The Tiananmen Square he had walked on in 1950 with Big Mother Knife. The People's Square of Shanghai. The square courtyards of the Laneway House. The sheets of Zhu Li's music. The portraits of Chairman Mao. The bed he shared with Ling. The square record jackets he had burned. The frames of the radios that he built every day. The ancient philosophers believed in a square earth and a round or egg-shaped sky. The head is round, and the feet are square. The burial tomb is square. What might cause something to change shape, to expand, or be transformed? Weren't the works of Bach, the folded mirrors, the fugues and canons, both square and circular? But what if the piece of music in his mind could not be written? What if it must not be finished? The questions confused him. He knew they came from that other life inside him. Ai Ming appeared in the doorway. Are you writing, Ba? He put down his pencil. She was wearing clothes he didn't recognize, a dress that must have come from the neighbor. And it made Ai Ming look more grown up, more like a northern city girl. Iwen asked me to bring some blankets to Tiananmen Square, she said. These are donations from the neighbors, but she couldn't carry them all. Ma is going to help me. Do you want to come too? Ai Ming appeared thin, exhilarated. In the last few weeks, she had said nothing of Canada. It was almost midnight. Sparrow said yes. Yes, he would go with them. Perhaps tonight he would tell them both that he was leaving for Hong Kong. He would be gone briefly. Before they knew it, he would be home again. He would not abandon his life, but find a new beginning that included them. Outside, Ling was stacking the blankets onto their bicycles, securing them with twine. Every movement she made was precise, intentional. He had always loved this quality of hers. "You've been composing," she said. "A new sonata. It's nearly finished." "I'm glad, Sparrow." Her face was guarded, yet, in its curiosity, open to him. He wanted to tell her that attachment to another person, to the past, was shifting from moment to moment. Set in motion again, his own life was finally becoming clear. But Ling knew, he thought. Of course she already knew this. So many people, sent to labor camps like Ba Lut, taken away like Swirl or Wen, reassigned to distant provinces like Ling and Big Mother, had been denied a basic freedom, the right to raise their own children. They set off, Ai Ming leading, turning through the maze of alleyways that bypassed Chang'an Avenue. Ahead of Sparrow, Ling's hair twisted in the breeze. Her movements were strong and graceful, and the almond scent of her skin seemed to float back and hold him once more in thrall,
Following her, he had the sensation of rising up a flight of stairs. Even now, so late at night, there were people everywhere. Banner after banner read, "Chairman Deng Xiaoping, step down." He pedaled faster. He was side by side with his wife and daughter now, and they were folded into the tens of thousands who occupied the perimeter of Tiananmen Square day and night. They got down and began pushing their bicycles, Ai Ming leading the way. Inside the square, a student marshal, with startlingly long arms, recognized her and came to assist. When they reached the hunger strikers, Sparrow unknotted the twine and was about to carry the blankets inside when the long-armed student stopped him.
"Only students," he said sharply. "No outsiders."
Ai Ming had run ahead. In the lamplight, he could see the faint glow of her shape. She was speaking to a tall, pale girl with very short hair, the neighbor's daughter, Yi Wen. The girl looked desperately thin. Some of the hunger strikers were fast asleep. A few boys were singing quietly. The camp smelled of urine and garbage. Doctors and nurses in smocks and blue jeans hurried past. One nurse was slumped over a table.
"Quiet, quiet," another whispered loudly. "Can't you see they're trying to rest?"
A wiry old man in a blue uniform ran up. Excitedly, joyfully, he announced that the new Independent Workers' Union had officially called for a city-wide general strike. Sparrow was stunned, but no one else seemed to react. Ling Chu was speechless. She whispered to him, "How do they dare? How do we dare?" Minutes later, a girl ran in and said that General Secretary Zhao Ziyang and Premier Li Peng were on their way to the hunger strike command headquarters. The tent hustled into activity. And then nothing, as if news continuously arrived, burst, rained down, evaporated, and was no more. Ai Ming had wrapped her arms around the neighbor girl. They stayed that way for a few moments, their eyes closed, the girl rocking back and forth, weeping. An old woman came by the entrance. She was delivering water donations and, at the same time, eating a fried dough stick, and the guard hissed at her.
"No food here! No food!"
And the old woman, pale with shame, turned and fled. Ling tried to intervene.
"She's a citizen only trying to help."
"No food here!"
the student shouted.
"Be quiet!" the slumping nurse cried. "Just be quiet, please."
Ai Ming emerged, crying freely, and together they pushed their bicycles around the scattering of people. It was late, and they were hungry, so Ling led them to Comrade Barbarian. The kitchen was still open, though the menu was limited. The waitress said that the owner was making regular deliveries to the square to support the student marshals and volunteers. They ate in silence, and Sparrow finally said, "Ai Ming, you have to look after your health." His daughter stared at her plate. Streaks of dried tears had left white patches on her skin.
"But what about you, Pa?"
she said.
"In a week, you've aged a decade."
Ling sighed.
"Come on, everyone eat."
When they went back out, speakers were being dragged around, even though it was almost 3 in the morning. People had come out all over again, because the Student Broadcast Center was repeating the news that General Secretary Zhao Ziyang had indeed arrived, along with Premier Li Peng, and they were meeting with representatives of the hunger strike. After Deng Xiaoping, they were the highest-ranked leaders in the country. Sparrow was so exhausted, he felt as if his shoes were glued to the concrete. He did not know how many minutes passed before a staticky broadcast finally dribbled out of the speakers. It was now 4 in the morning. The sound was not good. Words were lost. General Secretary Zhao kept clearing his throat and starting over. The first clear words that filtered through were, "Students, we came too late." The square itself seemed to widen, like something pulling apart. "Students, I am sorry. Whatever you say and criticize about us is deserved. My purpose here now is to ask your forgiveness." He saw a look of pain pass over Ling's face. Only it wasn't pain, he realized, but fear. The general secretary's voice was reedy. He seemed to be struggling against overwhelming emotion. "You cannot continue to, after 7 days of hunger strike, to insist on continuing only until you have a satisfactory answer. You are still young, and have much time ahead of you." People from the restaurant had all come out now. Sparrow saw the waitress and 2 cooks and a few old diners in their undershirts. A jumble of teenagers.
"It's the same as always," one of them shouted. "They want us to be obedient and go home."
Murmuring all around, approval or disapproval, Sparrow could not tell.
"You are not like us," Comrade Zhao continued. "We are already old and do not matter. It was not easy for the country and your parents to nurture you to reach university. Now in your late teens and early 20s, you are sacrificing your lives. Students, can you think rationally for a moment? Now the situation is very dire, as you all know. The party and the nation are very anxious. The whole society is worried, and each day the situation is worsening. This cannot go on. You mean well, and have the interests of our country at heart. But if this goes on, it will go out of control, and will have various adverse effects. All in all, this is what I have in my mind. If you stop the hunger strike, the government will not close the door on dialogue, definitely not. What you have proposed, we can continue to discuss. It is slow. Some issues are being broached. I just wanted to visit you today, and at the same time, tell you how we feel, and hope that you will calmly think about this. Under irrational circumstances, it is hard to think clearly. All the vigor that you have as young people, we understand, because we too were young once. We too protested, and we too laid our bodies on the railway tracks without considering the consequences. Finally, I ask again, sincerely, that you calmly think about what happens from now on. A lot of things can be resolved. I hope that you will end the hunger strike soon, and I thank you."
The broadcast devolved into static. Sparrow looked up at the sky. It was too bright in the city to see any stars. Everywhere he looked was a deep blue, a never quite black. "What does it mean?" Ai Ming said. Ling was weeping. "I want to go home," Ai Ming said. She was still so young, but why did she already look so empty? "I want to go home." Now it was Sparrow who led them, silently, as if they were thieves, through the dark night, past speakers, where Zhao Ziyang's address was being replayed.
"Students, we came too late. I am sorry."
Past groups of people listening for the first time, past blossoming trees and a row of magnolias whose flowers he couldn't see, but whose fragrance remained in the air, unrelenting, intoxicating. Late the next morning, when he woke, disoriented, he heard Yiwen telling everyone that General Secretary Zhao Ziyang had been removed from office. Someone inside the party had leaked this information. Demonstrations had broken out in 151 cities, and the government intended to declare martial law. The army had already arrived at the perimeter of the city. The national examinations still had to be written. To Ai Ming, the entire process was plainly ludicrous. Theory and practice, practice and theory. If she analyzed another poem by Tu Fu, she might go into exile herself. She was curled up on the sofa, eating a cucumber, when Sparrow appeared groggy, all the hair on his head mashed to one side. After wishing him good morning, she asked him, "Were you fighting someone in your sleep?" Sparrow smiled confusedly. He took the cucumber from her hand and started to eat it. Radios blared in the alleyway. Families were shouting at each other about matters big and small. But she and Sparrow both pretended they heard nothing. Ai Ming told him that early this morning she had been determined to study. She had opened the exam catalog and found herself at the 1977 questions. That year, the national essay had been, "Is it true that the more knowledge, the more counter-revolutionary?" Write at least 800 characters. What if a similar question appeared on this year's test? For over an hour, she had struggled to compose an opening line. The page was still blank. She could no longer make sense of the word counter-revolutionary. Sparrow crunched the cucumber and listened. "How can I write the examinations?" she said. "How should I—" "Don't worry so much about the essay question." Her father's voice sounded thick, like a full sponge. "Why don't you go back to studying literature or mathematics?" She nodded, but this wasn't what she meant. It was the whole idea of answering. The fear that every word had multiple meanings, that she was not in control of what they said. Sparrow said that he was going to the factory to see what was happening. Had he forgotten what year this was? And why did he look like he was in pain? It was only now that she realized he was wearing his factory uniform. "But Ba," she said, "everyone says the army will come in from that side, from Feng Tai." He nodded without hearing. "Ai Ming, don't go to the square today. Promise me." He looked at the door, then back again. "Where's your mother?"
"Radio station."
"Oh." He nodded, but his eyes were glassy. "Ai Ming, I have a friend in Canada who might sponsor you. I'm willing to do everything I can. I'm going to meet with him in Hong Kong in June."
"What friend? You're going to Hong Kong?"
"But first you must write the examinations, and you must do well. Without a high score, even sponsorship won't help you."
He was talking in a kind of perturbed state. Was it a trick, she wondered, so that she would stay where she was, live inside books, ignore what was happening to her thoughts? And who was this friend?
"I'll excel in the examinations."
When she said this, the bird of quiet looked incredibly glad, like a child. She tried to steel herself against her father's innocent smile. "You're a good child, Ai Ming. A good daughter. I'm a lucky father." Sparrow left for the factory. Ai Ming changed her clothes, pulling on a dress of Yiwen's. In the courtyard, she took Yiwen's clothes down from the laundry line, stuffed them into a bag along with a toothbrush and washcloth, books, and a few coins her mother had given her. She hopped onto her bicycle and hurried out. The city seemed loosened by the heat. She pedaled hurriedly to Tiananmen Square, but found it unexpectedly quiet. One of the student marshals, a physics student, who called himself Kelvin, told her that Ewan had gone out with a battalion to the western suburbs in an effort to blockade the roads and prevent the army from reaching the square. Aiming turned around and cycled back the way she had come. At the Musidi Bridge, nobody could pass. Bicycles, buses with punctured tires, burned-out sofas, shouting people, and stockpiles of wood overflowed the intersection. When Aiming finally made it across, she glimpsed broken glass, swerved hard, and nearly collided with a scooter. The driver's, "Sorry, sorry," fluttered backwards. Her front tire made a sad sucking noise before going flat. She got down and began pushing the bicycle on. The scraping of the rim against concrete made her teeth ache. Unable to see through her tears, Aiming locked the stupid, useless, unforgivable bicycle to a tree, took the bag of clothes, and kept walking. Her whole body was coated in sweat. A bus came, and she jumped on. But almost immediately, the bus stopped. She tumbled out with the other passengers. Here was the army now. Army trucks, stretching as far as she could see. Aiming walked towards them. Tears, confusion, hysteria. The military trucks were surrounded by people. "Brother soldiers," an old man was shouting. He lurched in front of Aiming. His blue factory uniform sagged around him like a riverbed. "Do not become the shame of our nation. You are the sons of China. You, who should be defending these students with your lives, how can you enter our city with guns and bullets? Where is your conscience?" A few officers tried to make themselves heard above the commotion. They said their only mission was to keep the peace. Everyone was hysterical and calling out. An ancient grandmother had taken it upon herself to lie down in the road in front of the trucks. "Who are you retaking the streets from, huh?" she said hoarsely. "I'm no rebel. I was living here when your great-grandfather still wore short pants." A man in a factory uniform carrying dozens of individually wrapped cakes began dropping them indiscriminately over the railings of the trucks. "My daughter is in the square," he said. "My only child. I appeal to your courage. I appeal. I appeal." Aiming could not see Ewan anywhere. It was 1,000 times more crowded here than it had been at Tiananmen Square. She hugged the bag of clothes to her chest and stood in the mayhem, hungry, thirsty, shivering with fear, ashamed at having disobeyed her father. A soldier her age stared at her with palpable longing. "How did I end up here?" Aiming thought. "This is my country. This is the capital. But I don't belong in Beijing. Where is Ewan? If only I could find Ewan, I would know what to do." The afternoon was disappearing, but the crowds only grew larger. Some soldiers climbed out of their vehicles and stood in the road, humiliated. Some were in shock. Some looked angry. Some wept. On the fifth floor of the factory, all the seats were empty. Sparrow sat at his workstation, basking in the absolute stillness. This was the first peace he had known in days, and the quiet inside him now felt freed. It sat on the table, uncaged, like a housebird. Despite the emptiness, he felt as if his co-workers had left an after-image. Every workstation belonged unassailably to someone. Perhaps in a moment, Thaurin, Old B, and Fan would reappear, and it would be Sparrow himself who would dissolve, as if he had always been the illusion. The freedom of departure comforted him, and he put his head down on his arms
and fell into a sound, peaceful sleep. It was nearly 10 at night by the time Aiming found Yiwen, huddled with two other girls. One was called Lily, and one was called Fei. The girls were draped over one another and looked like a single body with three heads. Yiwen's father had told her that, until she quit the student demonstrations, she was no longer welcome at home. She had been sleeping in Fei's dormitory room. After learning that all three had been part of the hunger strike, which had officially been called off this afternoon, Aiming coaxed them to a nearby noodle stall. The vendor was a sleepy-eyed woman with a thick northeastern accent. "Take your money back," she said to Aiming, after the other girls had floated away to a table. "No, no, I mean it. I've got nothing to offer you kids but these noodles. They're good noodles, but they won't change the world." Embarrassed, Aiming thanked her. "So, what do you study?" the vendor asked. Aiming looked into the woman's puckered, hopeful face. "Chinese history?" The woman pulled her head back like a bird. "What's the use of that?" "Well, at least you know that my generation was tossed around by Chairman Mao's campaigns. Our lives were completely wasted. We've pinned all our hopes on you."
"The other girls study mathematics," Aiming said, trying again.
"That's what we need,"
the vendor said, smacking her chopsticks against the metal pot.
"Real numbers. Without real numbers, how can we fix our economy, make plans, understand what we need? Young lady, I don't mean to be rude, but you should really think about studying mathematics, too."
"I will." She carried the noodles to their table. There was something wary in the girl's eyes, but they softened when they saw the food.
"What will you do now?" Aiming asked.
Lily swallowed a mouthful of noodles.
"What can we do? I'm afraid to go back to the university. Maybe it's all a trap and they're waiting to arrest us on campus. In 1977, Wei Jingshen got 17 years in solitary confinement for writing one wall poster."
"We can't let them take the square."
Ewan's voice seemed to come from the plastic tabletop.
"We have to stop them here, in the streets. We have to fight the army. We can't let them through."
"The square is our headquarters," Lily said. "If we lose the square, we lose everything. Everything. Do you even know what they did to the protesters in 1977? That's what scares me. Nobody even remembers."
The table was low compared to the height of the chairs, and it made them all lean forward as if they were planning a conspiracy. Lily, Fei, and Yiwen kept talking, using other military terms. How could they talk about fighting the army? Aiming found her thoughts drifting nervously. If she didn't hear them, she wouldn't be implicated. Yiwen picked up her hand and held it, squeezing it so hard that a jolt of pain flashed in Aiming's eyes. On the public speakers, the grating repetition of the martial law announcement had started up again. "In accordance with Article 89, Item 16 of the Constitution of the People's Republic," waves of sound broke through the street.
"Down with Li Peng! Down with Li Peng!"
Still the voice on the loudspeaker crept out, insistent. "Under martial law, demonstrations, student strikes, work stoppages are banned."
"We've got to sleep here in the road, right in front of the trucks," Fei said. She had sleepy eyes and a demure chin, making her words all the more shocking. "I don't care what happens to me anymore. I don't care. What future is there for us anyway?"
"I'm so tired," Yiwen said. "Doesn't it seem a lifetime ago that Hu Yaobang died
and we all brought flowers to the square. That was April 22nd. All we wanted was to deliver a funeral wreath to the great hall of the people. That was the beginning, wasn't it? What's the date today? May 20th? Only 4 weeks since Comrade Hu's funeral.
Was that really how it had begun? Ai Ming wondered. Could it have been so simple? Girls at a nearby table sang an old Cultural Revolution song, and the words seemed both to lull the students and rouse them.
All these songs, Ewen said.
Her hand felt small and damp.
I never understood. I thought they were real.
They were just words, Ai Ming said. Lily looked at her, forthrightly, calmly.
But what else did we have?
When they finished eating, Lily and Faye went off to look for friends from Beijing Normal, and never returned. Ai Ming and Ewen joined the other students sleeping on newspapers on the ground. Ai Ming lay on her back. From here, the tanks appeared even more monstrous. Frightened, she closed her eyes against the increasing clarity of the stars. The most important people in her life were Sparrow, Ling, Big Mother Knife, Balut, and now Ewen, and it was like they had all been raised on different planets.
It's easy to say we'll sacrifice our lives for the country, Ewen said quietly. At the beginning, it feels very brave. Is it what you meant, Ai Ming? You said it was just words. You think that the things that matter are more difficult than words. To retreat from a confrontation, for instance. To work at changing something, truly changing something. She lifted her hand towards the bodies and the tanks. Ai Ming, you're studying history to prepare for the examinations. What if revolution and violence are the only way?
Beside them, army soldiers were speaking softly in their uncomfortable trucks. They were so crowded that the soldiers had to take turns, even to sit down. Ai Ming tried to clear her thoughts. All these slogans and songs had been handed down, she thought, and if the words were not theirs, was the emotion that propelled them borrowed, too? What about the students' desire? Their idealism, their righteousness. How many contradictory desires did it serve? Once, idealism had belonged to Chairman Mao, the revolutionaries, the heroic Eighth Route Army. Had their generation inherited it? How could a person know the difference between what was real and what was merely illusion, or see when a truth transformed into its opposite? What was theirs, and what was something handed down, only a repetition? The loudspeakers kept cutting into the air. Under martial law, soldiers are authorized to use all necessary means, including force. Hadn't the government, too, stolen their words from somewhere else? People are forbidden to fabricate or spread rumors, network, make public speeches, distribute leaflets, or incite social turmoil. As if words alone could make reality, as if there were no people involved, as if words alone could make someone a criminal, or conjure crimes from the air. Hadn't the Red Guards tried to destroy the old language and bring to life a new one? What if one had to create a whole new language in order to learn to be oneself? She said to Ewen, I think we keep repeating the same mistakes. Maybe we should mistrust every idea we think is original, and ours alone. Ewen's head nodded against her shoulder. They both smelled the same, like the noodles they had eaten, and also the ashy ground. How did Ewen see her? Was she a sister, a friend, a confidant, something else? Here is the one thing in my life, Ai Ming thought, that has no parameters. She wanted to tell Ewen how she felt,
but she was afraid to damage everything they had.
"I can't sleep," Yiwen said. "Tell me a story."
Aiming could think of nothing, no words that belonged to her. "I'm 18 years old," she thought, "and I still haven't begun to know my own thoughts." She felt as if a part of herself was being left behind. She squeezed her eyes shut and recited the only words that came to her. The poem at the opening of chapter 41 of the Book of Records. "Of course no one knows tomorrow. Tomorrow begins from another dawn, when we will be fast asleep. Remember what I say, not everything will pass." It was dawn by the time Sparrow cycled home from the factory. The 1981 recording of the Goldberg Variations rippled through his headphones, and the music felt both long and momentary. For this new recording, Glenn Gould had instilled a continuous tempo, a pulse, so that all 30 variations more clearly belonged to a unified piece. A few weeks after the 1981 recording was released, Glenn Gould had died suddenly at the age of 50. Sparrow had not learned of Gould's death until years later, and convinced himself the radio announcer was mistaken. So much so that a few months ago, when a letter from Kai mentioned the death of Glenn Gould, Sparrow had been upset by it all over again. What kind of man had the celebrated pianist been? He wondered. If Gould had been prevented from playing the piano for 20 years, what other form might his music have taken? It must have rained not long ago. The air felt renewed. The dawn light was the color of pearls, unreal against the pavement. Turning onto Guang'an Road, he almost fell off his bicycle when he saw the army trucks. They were surrounded by a restless crowd, people in their nightclothes and others on their way to work. Hastily he swung his bicycle around and detoured south. The Goldberg Variations continued in his ears, but when he tried to reach the center, he met checkpoint after checkpoint. Beijing, with its grid of ring roads and bridges, had been solidly designed to protect its heart, Tiananmen Square, and the Forbidden City. Smaller roads were manned by students, but along all the major thoroughfares, Beijing residents had set up human barricades, crowds so dense no army truck could hope to cross without meeting violent resistance. He pressed on through ever more congested streets. Sparrow smelled bonfires, even though nothing burned. The smell brought back an image of Wu Bei, struggling to stand on his tiny chair as the Red Guards humiliated him. "The monster is waking, teacher. You have stepped on its head countless times, and now the monster is crawling out of the mud." At the barricades, as if in uneasy counterpoint, people chanted, "We must turn over and awaken! We must sacrifice and serve the revolution!" Yet Gould continued, unrolling one variation and tipping in slow motion towards the next. By the time Sparrow reached home, it was nearly 10 in the morning. The rooms were empty. He sat at the table and drank a cup of tea. Noise from the ongoing demonstrations filled the room. Radio Beijing didn't broadcast music anymore. Instead, the loudspeakers kept repeating the fact of martial law. He regretted all the radios he had ever built. He wanted to find some way to cut all the wires, to hush all the voices, to broadcast stillness, quiet, on this city that was coming unmoored. Late in the afternoon, he woke suddenly. Here was his daughter's face hovering above him, slowly sharpening. "Ba," she said, "Ba." She kept repeating that representatives from Wire Factory No. 3 were in the living room. He got up. Aiming brought him a basin of cold water. Sparrow dunked his face, thinking he had been reprioritized out of his job. Instead, he came out to find Miss Lu and Old B in their factory uniforms, sitting on the sofa, eating peanuts. They smiled nervously when Sparrow said, "Have you just come off your shift?" Miss Lu recovered a peanut that had fallen between two cushions. When she had it firmly between her fingers, she pointed it at him and said, "Old B and I have finally decided to join the independent union. They've been canvassing in Tiananmen Square, you know. The Beijing Workers' Autonomous Federation." She cracked the shell and threw the peanuts into her mouth. Old B leaned forward.
"Let's just say we're tired of sitting on the hilltop and watching the tigers fight. Maybe you are too, Comrade Sparrow, and if so, we should stick together."
Aiming had followed him out. He could hear the flat squeak of her slippers behind him. "Yes. Okay." Old B and Miss Lu kept looking at him, as if they were still waiting for an answer. How could he learn to see around corners? What mistake was about to lunge towards him? Miss Lu said,
"You need to show your work unit ID and register your real name. We understand if you'd rather not. After all, you've got a family to think of."
"Wait, I'll get it." Sparrow went to the bedroom, found his ID card, and put it into his pocket. A new letter from Kai was sitting on the dresser in plain sight. Aiming must have placed it there. She had followed him in the bedroom. But before she could say anything, he told her he was going to the square.
"I want you to stay inside."
He said it sharply, as if she had already disobeyed him. He picked up the letter and placed it, too, in his pocket.
"Baba."
"For once, Aiming, do as I ask."
Outside, he watched, lightheaded, as Old B unlocked his bicycle. As they left the alleyway, Sparrow pedaled behind them. Miss Lu was balanced on the back of Old B's bike, and her old-fashioned cloth shoes sat daintily in the air. She stretched a hand out, handing him a cigarette. It was a good brand. Big Front Gate.
"Baby Corn was on the barricades last night,"
Miss Lu said.
"He told us 2 million Beijingers are on the streets. He said he ripped up his party membership card."
The cigarette tasted opulent in his mouth.
"It's all getting so emotional,"
Old B said.
"All these tears and threats are obscuring the bigger issues. We could help these students, steer the ship, but who listens to the older generation?"
Smoke clouded from Miss Lu's mouth.
"That's right. We had our day, and look how well we served the country." "Oh, yes. We Red Guards were very first class. Very rational."
Old B pretended he hadn't heard. They came to a large tent on the northwest corner of the square, temporary headquarters of the Independent Union, where a lineup of uniformed workers stretched along the boulevard. Jokes were passed from person to person, like midday snacks. 2 hours later, upon reaching the front, Sparrow signed his name below thousands of others. He felt too afraid to be afraid. A giddy volunteer informed him, hands gesticulating, that workers were organizing themselves into various battalions. Some were in charge of gathering supplies, some would battle the army at the roadblocks, and others had joined the Iron-Mounted Soldiers, a motorcycle reconnaissance network. Distracted by the sound of helicopters, Sparrow told the volunteer he would do whatever was needed, but he didn't own a motorcycle.
"Oh! Oh!"
Fan said, suddenly appearing with her booming voice.
"Be practical, Old Sparrow. You're not a kid anymore.
I don't see you leaping up on barricades, just falling off them.
Falling down is also a